Hey, I'm Roberta Blevins, and this is Life After MLM, a podcast where we work to end the stigma of failure in an industry systemically designed for you to fail. Join us as we dive into the real life stories of survivors, experts, and advocates to debunk the common myths and fallacies of cults, scams, and multi-level marketing. Hey, just popping in really quick to do a little bit of housekeeping before we start the episode. I want to let you know that the chat you're about to listen to that I had with Doug Brooks was recorded back in September before I upgraded my mic. And so the sound is not as good as it has been, and I apologize for that. But the talk is great. And so, you know, give and take. Secondly, I want to let you know that we've started our YouTube show. Yay! It is called Life After MLM, The Show. Thank you so much to everybody that was there on our live pilot episode. We will be streaming every Friday morning at 9 Pacific Standard Time. For about an hour, hour and a half, we're just going to sort of let it go and let it see where it takes us. But we're going to have experts, advocates, activists, victims, survivors, the whole shebang, right? It's basically if this podcast was live and had more than one guest. I can't always promise a focus, but we're going to try to have a topic focus every week and have experts for that focus so that we can discuss just deeper issues that are in multi-level marketing. I just want to create a really nice, open, and safe space for us to have these discussions and keep it educational. So it's been really fun so far. We've got a couple topics that are coming up. If you are listening going, oh my gosh, I really want to be on that, or I have a really great topic, or here's something that I've really wanted to dive into, let me know, hit me up, leave a comment, send me an email, whatever way you'd like to. I am currently looking for topics, currently looking for panelists, and really anybody that wants to be a part of this. So if you think you've got a great idea and that you want to do this, I would be so happy to have you. We're going to continue to keep this momentum growing and this community growing, and treat this almost like a living resource. I'm so excited. Anyway, that's just the beginning of 2022. Please make sure you're following us on social media so that you don't miss any of this stuff, and enjoy the show. Hi, and welcome back to another episode of Life After MLM. This is a really exciting episode today. We have Douglas Brooks, MLM lawyer extraordinaire, and we are going to talk about MLM and legal stuff and sort of his whole entire career. So it's lovely to have you, Doug. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Please introduce yourself and let us know how you even got started with MLM.
Well, thanks. First, thanks very much for having me on, Roberta. I think you are doing very important work, having creating a space where people can talk about their experiences. When I first started bringing MLM cases, there wasn't anything like this. And that's one of the most exciting developments in this area over the past few years, is that people like you and others in the, I'll call it the anti-MLM community, are out there. And you are talking with victims and letting people know that they're not alone, that the reason they failed is not because they didn't follow the plan, or they're stupid, or they can't do sales, or anything like that. The reason they failed is that because they got involved in a system that is designed to fail for most of the people that are involved in it. So I'm very happy to help you along. You mentioned Bob Fitzpatrick before. Bob and I have been friends and colleagues for decades, really, and we have, one of the things we talk about lately is the fact that, you know, we've been speaking out all these years, but haven't really gotten any traction. Now I think, you know, you guys out in social media and podcasts and YouTubes and whatever, you are getting traction, and I think we're going to see some interesting developments in the regulation and treatment of MLMs by the regulators. So I'm very excited to be doing this now.
Yes. I mean, I always tell people, you know, they're like, this anti-MLM community, this movement is so new. And I say, no. They are the OGs. We've got Doug, we've got Bob, we've got the late John Taylor, wonderful Dr. John Taylor. These people, you guys have paved the way. You laid the brick road. And we are now happily skipping toward the Emerald City on it. So you guys were the people that laid that brick road. So
I give you so much credit and thank you so much for having that education and having those statistics so that when people like me were wronged and we went looking for them, that it did take us some time to find them, but we did. And we were able to sort of build off of that. And I think collectively, we're getting more traction than this movement's ever gotten ever before. So it's incredibly exciting. So thank you for your groundwork.
Well, thanks. Although I think my skipping days are behind me, but I appreciate that comment.
Oh yeah, no, it really does feel like that. It feels like you guys paved the road and we're like, okay, it's ready to go. Let's go. So we're definitely on the way to the Emerald City. So what got you interested in litigating multi-level marketing?
Well, back in the 80s and early 90s, I was in a firm that specialized in representing franchisees. We represented franchisees all over the country, and I learned a great deal about how franchising works. And we also represented distributors in traditional types of distribution arrangements. So the whole area of distribution, where you have these relationships of wholesaler and retailer, or wholesaler and distributor, or those relationships, they cooperate most of the time, but they're fraught with difficulties, and sometimes there's litigation, and sometimes there are problems, and you try to work them out, and if you can't work them out, then you have to go to court. So I did those types of cases for a number of years, and then one of my partners, one of my colleagues in that firm decided, we decided to leave and open our own firm, and we shared office space with a firm that did class action work. And we ended up, because we had no money to pay rent, we were sort of trading our time for space. And we started working on some of their cases. This is a firm that did a lot of securities fraud class actions and consumer protection class actions. And they had filed a number of cases involving multi-level marketing companies. And we said, well, hey, we've been in the distribution area. We can handle these cases. This should be, we could just, fall off the truck and do these. Well, and so we took them on, but we realized fairly early on that this is a very different animal. This is not like any other kind of distribution. In fact, I think at this point we're questioning whether it really is a form of product distribution at all. It really seems to be a scam dressed up as a product distribution system. But by that point, I was hooked, and I started doing more and more class action work. And we did many other types of cases involving class actions. We did securities fraud, and we did antitrust and product defects. But the cases that always sort of got my got my blood flowing were these pyramid scheme cases. They're very difficult cases from the lawyer's point of view. They're not attractive economically, but there's something about the whole setup and the whole system that has really got me hooked. And at this point, I'm not actively doing class action work, but I am active in trying to advocate for better regulation, better disclosure, better transparency in the whole MLM area. Where I got started was sort of falling into it without really a plan. We actually, one of our earliest cases, it was the Webster versus Omnitrition case, from which we got a great decision from the Ninth Circuit. But that case started, for us at any rate, one of our former franchise clients we had gotten a good result. Actually, there were a group of clients in this particular franchise. After we got him out of that franchise deal, he got involved in Omnitrition, And he came to us and said, you know, hey, I lost, you know, some money in this, you know, can you do anything about it? And that case, there were a number of other cases that were filed around the country that ultimately got consolidated. And that ended up to be one of the leading cases at the time on what constitutes a pyramid scheme and what laws are available to distributors who've been victimized by one of these things.
Yeah. And one of the quotes like that you said, and I'm sort of paraphrasing because I just quickly jotted down some notes, but in the Om Nutrition International, you said an MLM could not avoid being characterized as a pyramid scheme because of the rules against front loading and requiring sales. So just because there's rules that say you shouldn't do that doesn't mean it's not still a pyramid scheme.
They have to be enforced and they have to be effective. And that goes back, I mean, the law regarding these entities, this multi-level marketing industry, go back to the 1970s. There's no federal statute that defines what a pyramid scheme is or even that governs multi-level marketing. There are some state laws and unfortunately, the Direct Selling Association has been working very hard to get those laws changed so that they allow the industry to continue the way it has been. But at the federal level, there's no law that specifically addresses it. There is the Federal Trade Commission Act, which is enforced by the Federal Trade Commission, in general terms, prohibits unfair or deceptive acts or practices in trade or commerce. And early on, back in the 70s, the FTC decided that pyramid schemes would be considered an unfair, deceptive practice. But they never came up with a rule or a regulation that defines what a pyramid scheme is. They developed the definition through a series of cases. And unfortunately, each time they bring a case, they have to sort of re-establish that definition. But back in the 1970s, there were, of the cases that they brought, there are two cases that sort of set the stage for everything that happened later. The first case was the Koscott Interplanetary case, which Koscott, KOSCOT, was a cosmetics MLM, and it was developed by one of the more colorful characters in the area, a guy named Glenn Turner, and he, all the elements that we know and love today were present back then. You know, the big meetings with everybody getting all excited and you know, jumping on their chairs and you know, all the hype and all the talk about how this is going to change your life and how everyone's going to be rich and all you have to do is recruit, and you'll be relaxing on the beaches of the world. It was all there back, you know, 50 years ago. And the FTC, and of course a number of states went after Glenn Turner and his companies. And finally, the FTC moved, and they ultimately shut down Koscott, and they issued an opinion where they said, okay, here's why Koscott is a pyramid scheme, and here's what they're going to be prohibited from doing in the future. What they're prohibited from doing is having a system where you pay for the right to recruit other people and receive compensation when those people join the plan, and that compensation is not related to bona fide retail sales. And they were very clear in that decision. Retail sales meant sales to people who weren't participants in the plan, and consummated sales, actual sales that have taken place. It's okay to have a plan where you get paid a commission based on a sale that has happened. That's okay. You could tell that the FTC was struggling a bit with whether to even permit the whole multi-level, you know, unlimited recruiting type of thing. There's a passage in the opinion which says, essentially says, we wonder whether we should even allow plans that are based on retailing, because even if you do have retail sales at the bottom, you're still faced with a situation where if you have unlimited recruiting, that, you know, at some point, people are not going to find enough customers to buy this stuff.
Right. I mean, the mathematical side of this comes in, yeah, and it's very obvious. Like Bob always says, like, what, 13 levels of getting five people to get five people, and you run out of people on Earth. And that includes third world countries, people on their deathbeds, people that are literally being born right now. It's mathematically impossible. Until we figure out interplanetary space travel and we open it up to Mars, like, there just isn't more people that we can get into these scams. There just isn't.
Yeah. And what happens is, you know, tragically what happens is the companies don't collapse because people keep on dropping out. And that's the system. The system is built on failure. It's not like, you know, failure is a byproduct. Failure is the product. You know, a few people rise, but most people drop out. And the key is, from the MLM's point of view, is keep those people in as long as possible. Suck all the you can out of their wallets and their credit cards, you know, bleed them dry, and then let them drop out. And then the commissions that would have been paid to them go up the chain. That's a feature called breakage. The high-level people that move from plan to plan, one of the things they look at is you know, where does the breakage go? You know, who gets those commissions that people don't qualify for?
I also want to talk to you about, because you mentioned it and I wrote it down in my notes, that you used to do the franchise stuff. And I hear so many times when people are trying to defend themselves, especially when I'm presenting facts, that these people come to me and they say, well, this just sounds like a franchise, or they're just my distributor, or I'm just buying product and then selling it. But you and I both know that that's not true. Is there a way that we can break that down in like the simplest terms so that everybody else also can understand that?
Well, let me look at this. One of the types of cases that I handled when I was doing franchise work was, we call them cannibalization cases. Those are cases where the franchisor builds a store that's too close to an existing store, and they cause an impact on that existing store. You know, franchisees and franchisors, they agree on a lot of things. You know, you wouldn't buy the franchise if you didn't like the burger, you know, type of thing. But if you're a Burger King franchisee, you can compete with McDonald's. If a McDonald's opens across the street, you know, they can say, well, we have a special sauce, and you can say, but we're flame broiled. Flame broiled is better. But what you can't do is you can't compete with another Burger King across the street, because you're selling the same stuff at the same price to the same people. You know, the only way you can compete is by lowering your prices, and you will eventually go out of business. So you need to not have a Burger King across the street. You can deal with an Arby's or a McDonald's or a Wendy's, but you know, you need to have a little bit of protected territory. Now, Burger King doesn't give territories. They don't give protected territories. But they do study the market before they build a new store. And if a new store is going to cause too much of an impact on an existing store, they won't build it, usually. And now it's the usually part that leads to litigation, because sometimes there are disagreements on you know, the franchisor said, well, we did a study and, you know, you're going to be fine and don't worry about it. And the franchisee says, well, you built the store and you're killing me. What, you know, what are you going to do about it? And so that's when the lawyers step in. And I had a case called Burger King, Sheck versus Burger King. And Sheck was a franchisee, had a store. Burger King built a store, with, you know, simplifying the case, Burger King built a store that, had a huge impact on his existing store. We sued. One of the grounds, one of the bases that we sued on was that Burger King breached the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. You know, even though there's no explicit territory, they had a duty to basically not to destroy this guy's business. Burger King, and we got the judge to agree with us. The judge said, just because you don't have a protected territory, that doesn't give Burger King the right to build wherever they want to if it's going to screw you. That case, it's a very controversial case in the franchise world. There's, you know, a lot of the franchisor lawyers like to attack it, but as far as I know, it's still good law, and that goes back, you know, about 30 years.
So if we were to like put MLM into that, it would be like every single person going into Burger King saying, right, "Hey, I really like this flame broiled burger," and they're like, "You know what? I've been watching you walk around the store. I think you should own your own franchise." And then literally having Burger King's, like, I don't know, 150 of them in one town.
Right. That's the thing. You know, franchisees want to have exclusive markets. Franchisors want to increase sales. So a franchisor, if they want to make $1 million, they don't care if they have 100 people doing, do my math here, $10,000 or 10,000 people doing $100. You know, they get their $1 million either way. But franchisors also recognize that in order to have a healthy distribution system, they need to have healthy franchisees. They need to have, they need to give the franchisee a reasonable opportunity to succeed. They need to give the franchisee, you know, the franchisee has to have some chance of having a viable business. And the franchisee knows, well, yeah, it might be nice to be the only store in town, but I benefit from the network effect. I benefit from having other Burger Kings in other towns because people will see my sign and say, oh yeah, I went to that store, you know, two towns ago and it was good food, so I'm going to go here now. So there's a balance there. When you get to MLM, there's no balance because you, as you were just saying, you're recruiting your competition. There's no limit on the number of distributors. There's no protected territories. If you as a distributor are recruiting other distributors, you're recruiting your competitors. And you're recruiting, if you're recruiting in your warm market, as they say, you are recruiting your customers to become your competitors. And fundamentally, it doesn't make sense from a distribution point of view. So the only way, ultimately we find out the only way to make money is by recruiting. You can't make money by retailing because, you know, there's someone always there. And there's someone there, and their incentive is to sell at cost or even a little bit lower, because here's the kicker. Because it's not enough that there's no territorial protection and no limitation on the number of distributors. The kicker is you've got inventory purchase requirements that you have to meet. There's no way to rise up in the plan, and there's no way to qualify to earn commission unless you account for a certain level of sales. And you know, show me an MLM compensation plan, and I will find for you, or you will find for yourself, that there is some level of purchase that you are required to meet in order to participate in the plan. The MLM company, they will stand on a stack of Bibles and swear that the only purchase requirement they have is the starter kit, you know, for $50 or $100. That's the only thing you have to buy, and now you're a distributor, and you know the world is your oyster. Everything else is optional. We have to get real here. You know, if you're actually going to be a distributor, you're actually going to participate in the thing, and you're going to recruit people, you want to make commission based on what those recruits do. And the only way to qualify for commission is by buying X amount of stuff, you're going to buy X amount of stuff.
Yeah.
And that's what the whole the whole marketing push, when you go to these meetings and the extravaganzas and whatever, they want you to keep on buying stuff. I mean, that's if you're serious about the business, they say, you will, you know, you've got to be a product of the product. You've got to buy this stuff. How can you possibly sell the stuff unless you use it yourself? I mean, that's the line you're going to hear a million times over. That's my franchise versus MLM example. You know, and a sensible distribution versus a fantasy, you know, Wizard of Oz distribution.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like I said, like if everybody owned, you know, then nobody owns, right? If everybody sells hamburgers, then nobody really sells hamburgers because we're all selling it. We don't need to buy it. Yeah. So it's so silly, right? It's like people don't see that. They go, oh, you love this lipstick. You should sell it. Okay, but you sell it. Why do I need to sell it if you sell it? If you sell it, I can get it from you. I don't need to sell it to get it. I know 100 people that sell it. And that's the other thing, like, right? You can think of any MLM in your head, and most likely you know at least one person that sells for that MLM. At least one.
No, it's true. It's everywhere.
Right? And yeah. It's not a Starbucks, right? It's not a Starbucks. People will say this to me too. Well, there's Starbucks everywhere. There's a Starbucks in every corner. And I'm like, and there's a line out every single Starbucks. That's why there's another Starbucks down the street. Like,
and that's a company owned system too. Those are not separate franchises. That's you know, Starbucks made a decision that we're not going to franchise. We're going to be vertically integrated. And so we can build next door if we want to. The only person we're hurting is ourselves, you know. But you're right. Every Starbucks you see, there's a line out the door. So, you know, they have a real product that people really want.
Yeah. You know, even if you don't like Starbucks and you're like, corporate coffee, you have to give it to them. Like, they know what they're doing. They're competing against themselves and they're doing great. There's literally I live in a tiny town. There are literally two Starbucks in town and they're in the same shopping center. One's in the grocery store and one is a freestanding store next to the grocery store. And both of them do amazingly well.
Yeah. But if there were 20 or 30, you know, you might begin to wonder.
And, right.
And with MLM, there's no limit on, you know, no one is making a decision. Well, here's a town of 30,000 people. We know that there should be, you know, 2.5 stores which will service that number of people. No one's making decisions like that. It's just total recruitment without regard to where the distributors should be or what markets we need to exploit or what, you know, what is the minimum size of a market that a distributor needs in order to be viable. No one's making decisions like that. It's irrelevant in MLM. The only thing that matters is recruiting, and how good a recruiter you are basically determines how much you're going to succeed in the business. So I mentioned the Costcott case. Amway was just a few years after Costcott, and the administrative law judge who decided it cited Costcott as the controlling authority. But then in the decision, he sort of totally turns around and runs away from Costcott, because Amway is a system where, first of all, like every other MLM you've seen, there's unlimited recruiting. There's no limitation on the number of recruits. There's no territorial protection. And you have to meet a certain level of purchases in order to qualify to earn commissions on your downline. And Amway pays commission before retail sales are made. In other words, the thing that triggers the payment of the commission is a distributor buying stuff. The system, you get paid a commission before that stuff is sold to a consumer. But Amway said to the FTC, well, it's okay because we have these rules that encourage distributors to make retail sales. We require distributors to sell to 10 different people every month. And we require distributors to sell 70% of their prior month's order before they make a new order. And we also require them to buy back stuff from their customers if the customer doesn't want it. And then they said those three rules encourage retail sales, and therefore you don't have to enforce this requirement that commissions are only paid based on consummated sales to non-participants. It's okay if people are our distributors love our products, they're going to buy them themselves, so they're their own customers. So we have this situation where, and then the FTC endorses that. They say, okay, Amway, you're not a pyramid scheme because you have these rules, and we believe you.
That's what I was about to ask you. So did they have to prove that they were actually enforcing these rules, or did they just have to say, we have them in place?
In the Amway decision, when you read that part where they talk about these rules, the footnote refers to the testimony of DeVos, I think it's Richard DeVos, and another Amway executive. I'm not sure. I'd have to look back at the decision, but in essence, the FTC agreed. You know, they bought the testimony of Amway executives who said, "Oh yes, we enforce these rules, and they effectively ensure retail sales." There's no reference to any actual effort to go out and see, well, where are these products being retailed? Who are the customers? But there was a finding that the rules were enforced and effective. So later on in my OmniTrition case, the Ninth Circuit picked up on that because OmniTrition said, hey, we've got the Amway rules, therefore we're not a pyramid scheme. And the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals said, well, yeah, we read Amway too, and in Amway there was a factual finding that those rules, not only were they in the contract, but they were actually enforced and they were effective. And therefore that the OmniTrition decision was on a motion for summary judgment, so there had not been a trial. The judge dismissed the case without a trial because OmniTrition had these Amway rules. We appealed, and the Ninth Circuit reversed in our favor and said, no, OmniTrition is going to have to prove that these rules are actually effective in ensuring retail sales. So from that Amway decision was 1979. So as of 1979, we've got two sort of regulatory models. We've got the Costcott approach, which says you have to have, you know, consummated retail sales to non-participants in order to be not be a pyramid scheme. And then you have Amway, which says, well, you just have to have these rules in place, and then you can do whatever you want. And so a company has an MLM company, they can follow the Costcott approach or they can follow the Amway approach. And of course, everyone follows the Amway approach. That was basically the state of the law until just a few years ago when the FTC prosecuted Herbalife. And in that Herbalife settlement and in some public statements that they've issued since then, they have said, guys, you know, the Amway rules never were, a panacea. They never were a guarantee that you weren't going to be considered to be a pyramid scheme. You have to have real retail sales, and you have to document them. And you can't just rely on distributors certifying that they've sold X amount of stuff. You actually have to be out there in the field, making sure that the stuff is really retailed. So right now, the past few years, the industry has been in a tizzy because, you know, for decades, they took the position that all you had to do was have these Amway rules or some version something like the Amway rules in your policies and procedures, and you're going to be fine. You know, that was, lawyers sometimes call that a safe harbor. If you have, you know, you have a certain provision that meets a set of requirements, and that protects you from being considered to be, well, in this case, a pyramid scheme. But that concept, yeah. So now Amway, the Amway rules are no longer a safe harbor. You know, the Herbalife settlement imposed real rigorous requirements as to documenting retail sales on MLM companies.
Yeah, absolutely. So another thing, because we're talking about Amway, that I like to bring up, and if people haven't read Ponzinomics by Bob Fitzpatrick, again, I'm going to plug that book and say that you should, but Bob talks about this. He talks about Neutralite, and Neutralite was, like, you know, one of the first OG MLMs, and they were selling these little like alfalfa pellet vitamins from, they were making in their garage. And, you know, the guys from Amway, they joined Neutralite. They were great salesmen. They had a huge downline. They decided we can do this better. And they left and they founded Amway. And they basically just made Neutralite, like baby Neutralite. And it was, they called it Amway, you know? And then Neutralite went down for being a pyramid scheme. And Amway continued to use Neutralite's business model and rules, even though they went down for being a pyramid scheme. And then in a fun twist that I love, they absorbed Neutralite and added Neutralite into their company and continued to operate as this Neutralite pyramid adjacent company. And then, you know, in 75, there was the case. And in 79, it was like we just talked about. And so everybody now says, oh, well, you know, Amway got through it and we're just like Amway. But like I just said, literally they absorbed a pyramid scheme and operate their business the same way, and somehow had this judge that looked at the case and said, you know, this looks fine. The dude that owns it says he's doing this, so I'm just going to trust him. Even though he's holding the smoking gun, it's totally fine. It's probably someone else's gun. He's just holding it for him. So I'm going to go ahead and say that we're A-okay and this is not a pyramid scheme, and you can go ahead and create hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds for the next 50 years, and everybody will be so hunky-dory and it's going to be great.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, Bob's book is great on a number of levels, but one of them is that he explains the politics involved and what was going on with Gerald Ford and Ronald Reagan. And then, it's a shame because what happened after 1979 is the industry explodes.
Do you ever wonder how much of your personal data is out there on the internet just for anyone to find? I promise it's more than you think. Your name, contact info, social security number, home address, even information about your family members. It's all being compiled by data brokers and openly sold online. This can lead to a lot of problems, including identity theft, phishing attempts, harassment, and unwanted spam calls. But now you can protect your privacy with Delete Me. Signing up for the service is super easy. Just provide Delete Me with exactly what information you want deleted, and their experts take it from there. They send you regular, personalized privacy reports showing what info they found, where they found it, and what they removed. I got my report and I was floored with the results. Of the 105 data brokers they checked, 83 of them had my data. DeleteMe then removed 173 listings of my personal data off the internet, and they make sure that it stays off too. Take control of your data and keep your private life private by signing up for Delete Me at a special discount just for our listeners. Get 20% off your Delete Me plan when you go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and use promo code MLM at checkout. The only way to get the 20% off is to go to joindeleteme.com/MLM and enter code MLM at checkout. That's joindeleteme.com/MLM, code MLM.
Because now people have a model. Okay, now we know how we can navigate the regulatory minefield. We're going to have these rules within a few years. You know, you have Herbalife, you have Nu Skin, you have, you know, all, you know, the big players all start in the early 80s, and the industry just explodes. It just it metastasizes because every time, you know, the high level people will fight with each other over downlines, and one group will split off and they'll start a new MLM, or an MLM every once in a while, one gets shut down by the FTC or maybe by a group of states going after them. And you know, it's like the Hydra from Greek mythology. You cut the heads off, but they live and they sprout new heads. And so, you know, new MLMs are sprouted and grow up. And you know, one of these days, I'd really love to sort of create a genealogy of all these companies, these people that have, over the years, they keep on, you know, they bounce from one company to another. One company folds, and then, you know, six more companies develop. I think that'd be an interesting project to do. I haven't had the time to put that together, but I'd love to try to do that because
I think it would be amazing.
Yeah.
I think it would be so unbelievably eye-opening to do the MLM family tree for people to be like, wait a second, doTERRA came from Young Living? We're like, mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, the guys who from OmniNutrition, they came from Herbalife. There are all sorts of twisted. One of the early MLMs that I sued, you had mentioned arbitration clauses before, was a company called Consumer Byline. Well, the leader of Consumer Byline was this guy named Keith Raniere. They got shut down, you know, after we filed our case about a year or so after, the New York AG shut him down, and he was barred from the MLM business. But he resurfaces a few years later with a group called Nexium. And Nexium, I think if you've been following the story at all, turned into this bizarre MLM-based cult with low levels and recruiting. But the product was enlightenment. And
enlightenment, personal growth, just hearing his name, it's just probably the most vile creature. Yeah. I'm not even going to call him a human. Most vile creature to climb out of the cracks of MLM. Like just disgusting creature.
But it's an interesting thing. And Bob has written about this as well, is that really from very early on, there was this relationship between MLM and the whole personal growth movement. I mentioned Glenn Turner earlier. Glenn Turner, not only did he have Coscott Interplanetary, the cosmetics MLM, he also had a personal growth business called Dare to be Great, which was also an MLM-based program, which also attracted a great deal of litigation. But Dare to be Great was, I would say, a precursor to Nexium. It was, you know, personal growth, how to be a better person, not just how to be a better salesperson, but how to be a better person, how to be successful. And the way to be successful, of course, is recruiting all your friends and making commissions based on the course fees that they pay.
There was another spiritual wellness MLM that popped up a few years ago. And I believe Terrell Tanstrom, who had a hand in helping create LuLaRoe and many other MLMs, was involved in this one as well. And it was called Bolo. And I think it only lasted for 6 months before people were like, you're not even selling a product. Like, this is clearly a pyramid scheme. And it folded. But yeah, it's just another one. I'm like, you guys aren't even selling anything other than, let me just talk to you and my enlightenment will be the product. I'm like, that sounds scammier than Herbalife.
But it is, and the same, you see the same message over and over again.
The answer to your prayers.
Yeah. What's your problem? What's your fear? What's, you know, what are your dreams? Oh, well, we can solve that. We are the, you know, MLM is the answer to whatever your problem is.
100%. I feel like anybody could come up with any vulnerability, and we hear it all the time on the show. I was in a divorce. I had just had a baby. I had just broken up with my boyfriend. I had just moved across the country. I just graduated college. It doesn't matter. You put yourself in a vulnerable position, and a scammer is going to come up and say, don't you want to have XYZ? Because they know you do. They're going to ask you a question that you're not ever going to be able to say no to. They're going to say, don't you want more for yourself? Who would say no to that? Don't you want to earn more money? Don't you want to be paid for what you're worth? Who would ever say no to those questions? The questions they give you are loaded. They are emotionally manipulative. They are 100% to get you to suspend disbelief for just 1 second. Because if you can suspend disbelief for just 1 second, the next time I might be able to get you to suspend it for two.
And what they do when they first recruit you is they ask you, well, what is your dream? What is your, are you afraid of being laid off? You know, do you want to send your kids to college or whatever it is? And then 6 months later, when, you know, you're saying, wait a minute, I'm not making any money at this thing. I think I'm going to drop out. And they go to you and say, well, what about your kids' college? Don't you care about your dream? I mean, you know, this is, and so they are, you know, all that stuff is recorded, and it's all part of the plan. They one of the first things they ask you, you know, what's your dream? And they also ask you to make a list of everyone you know before you even know that you're really getting involved in this. It's all part of the package, and it goes. It's basically the same thing from MLM to MLM. They all do a version of this, process.
Absolutely, and I want people to think back to any job interview they've ever been in. How many of them trained you on what to say if someone asks if you're a scam or a pyramid scheme? How many of them like fill it with balloons and rah-rah confetti and have people come up and tell their sob stories about how they used to be on food stamps and now they're buying a lake house? Like, how many job interviews have you been in where they're literally just trying to convince you and manipulate you when you're like, hey, I don't think this works for me. They're like, but what about your children? I thought you wanted to help retire your husband. I thought you wanted to bring him home from the oil fields. Do you not care about your husband anymore? You're just like, wait, whoa. No, I do. Of course I do. Like, well, no, you're right. Okay, I did. I started this business to help my husband. I got to put at least 6 more months. Well, you know, starting a business is hard work. And, you know, maybe you just aren't cut out to own your own business. Not everybody is. You shouldn't feel bad if you're just not cut out to do this. It takes a special kind of person. And they're manipulating you and they're making you feel like, well, no, I could do this. I can. You got to believe in me. It is so unbelievably manipulative. I need people to understand that. Because this is just not a regular job.
Just trust me. Give me a few more months, and you'll be there.
Absolutely. Oh my God. So you talked about arbitration clauses, and that's something that I really want to talk about because I know that there are people listening who, because I get their emails, hey, I was with XYZ. I'm thinking about talking to a lawyer. I'm thinking about starting a class action lawsuit. And I always say, read the contract. Read that arbitration clause. See if this is something you can even do. See if this is something you can even get into the Ninth Circuit. See if this is something that can even pass these crazy things that they've put into these contracts. You've been litigating for over 30 years. I know it hasn't been MLM the whole time, but just so people know some of the baddies that you've been up against, New Skin, Herbalife, Amway, Consumer Byline, Nexium, like those are big names. Okay, you are not some little guy that's never done anything. Like, those are humongous names. So
I never sued Amway.
You helped represent a victim of Amway.
I did. I did represent a woman who had a website called MLM Survivor, and she was sued by a high level Amway distributor for defamation. So that kind of stuff happens.
Yeah. So let's talk about that because, you know, I'm always very careful when I speak about my experiences to always talk about my experiences. I tell my guests, please speak on your experiences, things that you know can be corroborated. Don't accuse people of anything that they haven't done or that you assume they've done that you can't prove. It's always very important to protect yourself and to tell your own truth, which is something that I always do. Use the word alleged when I say, don't even try to accuse anybody of anything that you can't prove because they'll come after you. And I've seen it happen.
And even if you can prove it, I mean, the problem with our system is even if you can prove it, they may still sue you. And unless you have the wherewithal to defend yourself, you know, you're going to be in a tough situation. I'm representing or helping a young man who is being sued by an MLM in Canada right now, and this company has sued at least they brought at least 12 defamation suits in the past couple of years against critics. And the strategy is, you know, you file a suit very often in a jurisdiction that's far away from wherever the person lives. And, you know, you've got a law firm and they've got nothing. And, you know, the easiest thing for you to do is just to take your stuff offline and agree that you'll never talk about them again. And that's what they're going for. They're basically frightening people into not speaking out. So that is one of the things, and that as this anti-MLM movement grows, I think we're going to see more and more efforts to stifle people. So yeah. You're right to be careful. You asked about arbitration. In just about every MLM distributor agreement that you're going to see today, you're going to see a clause that says any disputes have to be resolved through arbitration, and then they'll also have the state where you have to go to resolve things. And right. There'll also be a clause, or it'll be part of that clause, that says no class actions. Any arbitration or litigation will only be on an individual basis. And that is at least as problematic as the arbitration clause. But those clauses, that's a double whammy. You're taking away the person's right to sue, and you're taking away the right to band together with other people, which is, as a practical matter, is very important, because if you're involved in an MLM and you lose money, you may have lost thousands, you may have lost tens of thousands of dollars. There are people who have even lost into six figures, but you know, not everybody has that kind of money to lose. But in order to pay a lawyer, litigation is very expensive. Most people cannot afford to pay legal fees on an hourly basis. So they need to find a lawyer who will take a case on a contingency fee basis. But a lawyer who looks at a case and say it's a $10,000 loss, they're going to say, I'm sorry, you may have the best case in the world, but if the best I can do is recover a $3,000 legal fee from a $10,000 claim, I can't take the case, because I'm going to spend 4 hours of time just to do my initial research. And you know, so it's the only way a multi-level marketing case can be brought by a civil plaintiff is as a class action, where instead of having one person who's lost $10,000, you have 100,000 people. And there, you know, then the lawyer can say, well, it's going to be a tough case, and you know, the chance I'm going to, you know, get through the whole thing are whatever they are, but at least there's a possibility that I will recover a decent fee at the end of it. So MLM companies, by putting in these class action waivers, they've taken away that ability. And the arbitration clause is similarly, if you can't go into court, if the only way you can do this is by arbitration, you are taking away, as a practical matter, the ability of victims to recover. I mean, it's one thing if arbitration clauses are very common in real distribution and franchise arrangements. And they may actually, I arbitrated a number of franchise cases. We, you know, if there were an arbitration clause, usually we didn't fight it. We would arbitrate. Those are, you know, franchisees can afford, hopefully can afford to pay legal fees. You know, there's a big enough amount of money at stake so that it's possible for a single franchisee case to be worthwhile. With MLM, if you take away that class action ability, and you force people to arbitrate. And that's the problem. And courts these days are tending to enforce those types of clauses. I have that consumer bylines case that I mentioned. That is actually a case where it was one of the first MLM contracts I saw, because it's going back to the early 90s. They had an arbitration clause in there. But we went to court, and the judge ruled that, well, you know, what you've alleged here is a pyramid scheme, and this is a New York-based company. And we did the research. You know, pyramid schemes are, violate the public policy of the state of New York. I'm not going to enforce a contract that violates New York public policy. I'm not going to enforce this contract because I'm essentially rewarding a company for being a pyramid scheme. So in a nutshell, I'm oversimplifying here, but that case, in the case, the judge refused to enforce the arbitration clauses. And there are cases where judges have not enforced our arbitration clauses, but it's becoming increasingly difficult because each time that happens, the guys that draft, the lawyers that draft these MLM distribution agreements, they take out their pencils and they revise the clause, basically get, they deal with whatever that, judgment was. And because you will also see in essentially every MLM distribution agreement, there's a clause that says, we can change this agreement whenever we want to, effective on notice to you.
Yes. This agreement can change at any time without any letting you know about it at all. Absolutely.
And then it's also, there's a clause that says this contract incorporates by reference our policies and procedures, and we can change our policies and procedures whenever we want, on notice to you.
At this point, if they change it because you signed that original contract, is there something in that original contract that says, because I've signed this original contract, I agree to all revisions of all other contracts in the future, no matter what it says?
Yes, that's what that clause is intended to mean.
So you're signing your life away and you're saying you can change this at any time and I'll completely continue to agree with it, no problem.
There are some cases, some judges look at that and they say, okay, this is ridiculous. You can't have a contract which one side can change at will to mean whatever they want it to mean. I'm the judge, saying there is no contract here. So therefore, I'm not going to enforce the arbitration clause because in essence, there's nothing to enforce because this is not a real contract. There are a few cases that have held that, but there's a lot of judges. That's sort of we're seeing a lot of judges appointed these days to be conservatives, on the bench, and there's a tendency to sort of enforce contracts as written. And so it's sort of the luck of the draw whether you can find a judge who will take a real hard look at a contract like that and say, I mean, this is not a real contract. This is just you can't have a situation where someone can just do whatever they want and call it a contract.
Right. And quick question, Doug, although I feel like I know the answer. What other industries have contracts like this besides multi-level marketing?
There's a lot of consumer agreements where you will see clauses like this. There are, your agreement with your credit card company or your telephone company or your cell phone company or your cable company.
So service contracts.
Yeah. Contracts where, there's this big imbalance, there's a lot of fine print, which no one ever reads. But if you actually look at it, you're going to see arbitration clauses. You're going to see, clauses about how we can change the deal, on notice. And maybe they'll give you 30 days to decide whether you want to agree to, and it's, you know, maybe it's some complicated privacy provision or something like that. But that's where you see it. You don't usually see them in sophisticated commercial agreements, because the parties are represented by lawyers, and they're going to say, no, we're not going to agree to allow you to change at will, the terms of the deal. We may agree to an arbitration clause, but we're not going to, we're not going to say, the deal is whatever you want it to be, whenever you want it to be it.
So in terms of like any other jobs, literally no other industry, the only way you're going to see these really like red tape, deep, you should have read the fine print contracts are going to be in these really, these services, right? These cable, phone, these sort of things where you're locking yourself into something for an extended amount of time.
That's true.
And then I have another question, and this is a LuLaRoe question just because this is what I know, but I know that LuLaRoe's arbitration clause requires you going to Wyoming for arbitration. So what would be the benefit of, as a company that's based in California, forcing arbitration to Wyoming?
Well, it's, that is called a choice of venue clause. And they're very common in sophisticated commercial agreements. But again, when you're talking about consumers, you're talking about MLM distributors, it is so unreasonable to expect someone in, Massachusetts or Florida or California to bring a lawsuit in Wyoming in order to enforce their rights. I mean, it's just not going to happen. Why would LuLaRoe do it? I don't know enough about LuLaRoe. Maybe do they have a law firm that they really like there, or do they just want to make it really, really difficult to sue them?
I mean, we could hypothesize.
Yes, and assume the worst.
But, yeah. I learned that from Game of Thrones, right? Like when someone wants to do something, when someone wants anything from you, the game you play is, what is the worst reason that they would want this favor or want me to do this thing? Peter Baelish taught me that. So that's very interesting. So the other question that I have is for people that are listening that maybe are listening through this and going, yeah, I still want to do a class action. I still want to go after the company that I've been with. The question I have for you is, do I have a case? And if I have a case, what are my next steps?
Yeah. So I want to give you a multi-part answer.
I appreciate it. I can't even tell you how many times I get emails that are like, I saw Lula Rich. I saw the Vice documentary. I watched your TikToks, whatever. Oh my God, I'm in a cult. Oh my God, an MLM. I looked at my money. I'm in the red. What do I do next? I want to sue them. I don't know. And I'm just like, okay, here we go. I gotta go above my pay grade on this answer.
Well, number one, I don't want people to call me. I mean, I'm happy to talk with folks, but I don't do class action work anymore. It's just, I'm a sole practitioner. This is my office. This is my staff.
Same.
I'm just not in a position to take on cases like that.
Yeah, absolutely not. I just want you as an amazing resource.
Well, thank you for that. Number one, what I tell people is, first of all, go to the FTC. The FTC has you can go to their website. They have a report fraud button, the form you can fill out online. Tell your story. It's really, really important that the regulators hear from people who have been victimized by these things. Because one of the things that we faced, folks like Bob and I and others who've been at this for a while, is there's this pattern that, in fact, the FTC has documented that victims of pyramid schemes are the least likely to report their fraud or that they've been defrauded as to any other type of fraud. And we need to study why that's the case. I think there's a lot of shame involved. There's a lot of guilt. There's fear. There are all sorts of reasons why people don't do that. But the regulators need to hear from victims. So go to the FTC. Go also to your state attorney general. Every state has an official that is supposed to be dealing with consumer protection. It shouldn't be too difficult to find out who that official is. And generally, they're going to have a website where you can click on a button, fill out a form online. So if you write something that you're going to send to the FTC, make sure you copy it and then go to your state attorney general and file the same thing. Tell the whole story. You know, what happened to you, how much money you lost, what went on. If you have documents, sometimes you can attach those documents to the thing. The regulators need to hear about this, and they can and they should act to protect people and shut these companies down. And hopefully, the problem with the regulators doing that is that most of the damage has already been done. By allowing these companies to operate, when the FTC goes after a pyramid scheme, they're almost always successful. In fact, I don't think they've always prevailed one way or the other. But in terms of recovering money for victims, it's usually pennies on the dollar because the money's gone. So number one, go to the regulators.
Yeah, and I have all of those links in at the very bottom of the show notes. There's always like a how can you help? And there's always there's a link to how to find your AG. There's a link to the report fraud. And there's a link to all of that stuff, even Truth in Advertising, send it there too. Send it to these consumer reporters as well and get it out there. Literally, like Doug said, copy and paste, send it everywhere. And how often should they do that, Doug? Should they only do it once or should they kind of every couple of months redo it?
Well, I don't advocate sort of flooding. That's one thing that the industry did when they were fighting the business opportunity rule. They got like 12,000 or 15,000 people to submit sort of cookie cutter comments, opposing what the business opportunity rule, when it was at first proposed, would have covered multi-level marketing companies. And the industry mounted this lobbying campaign, and they got exempted from the rule. So every other type of business opportunity has to provide pre-sale disclosures to prospective distributors, except for MLM. And that's the power of lobbying. And one of the things they did is they flooded the FTC with these sort of cookie cutter comments. I don't advocate doing that, but I do advocate following up. Every few months, say, hey, I submitted this complaint. Are you guys doing anything? And of course, they can't tell you if they're investigating. They're not going to tell you, but
just keep giving that squeaky wheel some grease every couple months.
It has to be, and volume matters. If 1,000 people complain, it's better than if 3 people complain. But they should all be real complaints, and they should all be individual. This is what happened to me. Don't copy someone else's complaint and submit it. Write your own. It doesn't have to be perfect English. It doesn't have to be, worded the way a lawyer would word it. It's actually very powerful to just write from the heart and say what you, what happened to you.
We saw the after effects of doing that in Washington State against LuLaRoe. That's how we got that movement there. So there is so much power in the public voice coming together and making these reports and letting the states and the FTC know, because they don't know, they can't read our minds. They don't know that we're having these horrible problems unless we tell them.
It's absolutely, absolutely right. And I'm glad to hear that you're all over that. But in terms of your own claim and bringing a class action, There are some firms that do this, and I suppose I should give this some more thought in terms of because I'm not sure that I know when I was doing this, it was always a bone of contention between me and my partners as to whether we should be doing these cases at all, because there were many more profitable cases that we were handling, and these MLM cases are very difficult. So it's not like there are certain types of cases that the plaintiffs' class action firms fight over. There are fights over who controls the case, because so many people, you might have 30 or 40 or 50 lawsuits involving one issue, and the lawyers will fight amongst themselves as to who controls the case. This usually doesn't happen with the MLM cases. They're not, they're just not that attractive from the lawyer's point of view. But as I say, there are some lawyers who are bringing these cases. Some very good lawyers that I know, and I certainly should talk with them before I sick a lot of people on.
Well, we could have a whole nother episode about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Does that answer that question?
I think so. I mean, if someone thinks that they have a case, then the best thing to do is to file those complaints, maybe find other people that are victims. Facebook groups are a great place to find support for the victims of MLM. There's lots of anti-MLM victim support groups. And there's even specific, there's LuLaRoe groups, there's Monet groups. So if one of those companies, if they don't have it, make one. If you were in it and you know people that were victimized as well, add them, create these groups, create these grassroots support groups, and get the people in there to complain to your state AG, to the FTC, to the media. That is how, I started talking about LuLaRoe 4 years ago, you guys. And this is what's happened in 4 years. This is not like yesterday I decided to start talking about LuLaRoe and they're like, okay, let's make a movie. 4 years of being on the ground, boots on the ground, working, helping, talking to victims, reporting things. It takes time. It takes so much time. It takes so many people. It's totally worth it. And it's amazing. And the validation and the catharsis when you actually get to go up against your victimizer and tell your story is incredible, but it takes time. And so you've got to start these grassroots things. You have to find other victims. You have to tell your stories. If you're listening to this, you're on the right track already. You're listening to other victim stories. Go a little bit deeper, start that group, join that group, find that group, and create this movement inside, because honestly, it's the victims' stories. It's the victims that will make the change. The loopholes in the FTC and the government, the only thing those loopholes do is they create more sophisticated scammers. So it's the public push. It's the social justice movement of, hey, there's a problem and no one's listening. So we're going to make so much noise that they can't not listen anymore.
You're absolutely right. And you've reminded me of one other thing that you should be doing.
Okay, let's hear it.
Go to your congressman, go to your senator, go to your congressman. Again, they all have websites. They all have online forms that you can fill out. Take that same, cut and paste your complaint from the FTC and tell your congressman about it. Right now, there's a direct selling caucus. There are congressmen who are essentially in the pocket of the industry, and anytime any law or regulation looks like it's going to get passed that might affect the industry, they're mobilized. There is no congressperson right now who is speaking out about this business. I don't know if someone somewhere is going to do it. I don't know who it is yet, but I'm pressing whatever buttons I can press, but go to your congressman the congressmen, they're always looking for, flagship issues. They're always looking for issues where they can sort of do good and also make themselves look good at the same time. And here's an issue where millions of people are getting ripped off every year to the tune of billions of dollars. Why doesn't one of these you know, young Congress people who you know, they need to get support, they need to get attention. Hey, here's an issue that someone needs to take. So, you know.
Man, they would have so many supporters behind them instantaneously.
Yeah.
If somebody were to actually say, look, we got to do this. We have to start this grassroots educational movement. I mean, you know, and here's the other thing that I want to say, because a lot of times people, if I bring up anything slightly political at all, people are like, ah. So I want people to know that MLM is not a red issue or a blue issue. It is smack dab in the middle. It is just, it's, you know, big tobacco, big pharma. They don't pick red or blue either. It affects every single person. And big pyramid is exactly the same. So when people are like, it's this and it's that, I'm like, maybe listen to the dream. Maybe read Ponzinomics. Yeah. It's not. It's both sides. And I remember reading Bob's book and some of the names that came up, and I was like, what?
Yeah. Madeleine Albright.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Person for Herbalife. I mean, what a,
yes.
What a, you know, just a tragic calculation on her part.
Just like your heart just ripped out and shredded. Like, I was like, she's like, it's a great product and I use it. And I was just like, what are you doing, Madeleine? What are you doing right now?
Yeah. Did you have anyone vetting this company or giving you any background on what you were getting into?
Right. So it's so important.
It's all over. Right. They are definitely, I mean, going back to the 70s, yeah, probably they're mostly on the GOP side, but they've become equal opportunity campaigners at this
Absolutely.
Point.
And one of my favorite websites is Open Secrets, where you can actually see where the PAC donations go. And if you go to the Direct Sellers Association, their caucus, and you look, that graph, some years it's super blue. And some years it's super red. And you can tell because they're trying to get people in office that will help their agenda. You guys talk about agendas all the time. It's going to help your agenda. This is a literal agenda and we're just ignoring it. So MLM is political, but it's not red or blue. It's just sort of, we should actually know what's going on so that we can combat this and fight it properly like you're doing.
Well,
thank you so much. Like,
well, thank you for having me. I think you're doing great work, and I look forward to, I've got to view more of your podcasts, but, and the whole LuLaRoe thing has been, very impressive. So,
thank you. You know, we're working really hard. There's so many of us behind the scenes getting this done, and it's been incredible. I don't know if you saw the documentary or not, but it's a fun ride.
Yeah, I haven't had a chance yet, but I've heard wonderful things about it. And of course, I'm very close with Bob, so I will definitely. I've been resisting, you know, enriching Jeff Bezos and Amazon, but I this will be a reason for me to sign up. So,
yeah, it is. It's great, and it's the thing that I like the most that I knew would happen. It's creating so many new conversations, and they're the conversations that we should have been having for a long time. And they're starting to happen now. And I'm just really excited that they're happening at all. It's, so thank you so much, Doug, for coming on and enlightening people and maybe giving them a couple jumping off points. If they want to fight these MLMs on the backside, I really appreciate all of your insight. And like I said, you paving the way so that we can do this stuff now. Everything that you guys have done, the lawsuits, the cases you've fought, the rules you've helped establish, you guys are the OGs. Thank you so much for laying down that brick road, because without you, we wouldn't be nearly as close to the Emerald City as we are now.
Well, thanks for that thought. And thank you for what you are doing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to Life After MLM. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share. And follow us on social media at Life After MLM Podcast and my advocacy at The Real Roberta Blevins. You can find all of the links to the social accounts in our show notes. And if you just listened to that incredible story and you thought, oh my God, I have a story just like that that needs to be told,
hit me up, therealrobertablevins@gmail.com. I would love to have you on the show to share your story and start your journey in life after MLM. See you next time, Huns.